Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Bio 241, November 24th. Huh? November 24th. I didn't drop everybody over the weekend. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure I dropped anybody over the weekend. Maybe a couple people. But you don't get points. You don't get points for attendance. Okay, so we're moving on to cardiovascular system today, and I just remembered that you had a test last week, and I didn't give the tests to your lab instructor this morning, those of you that had Monday classes. So if you're dying to find your grade before next Monday, you got to see me during office hours. I'll let you see your test and all that kind of stuff. But I did post all your grades on the internet as a PDF file, and I think that file is right here, so if you want to check your grades as you leave today, you can check your grades and see what else, what do you have to do on the remaining test to get a grade in the class. You can are welcome to do that. Do we have any announcements in SI?
Just today, because Thursday is the holiday. I'll be eating turkey. I don't know about the rest of you, but...
Okay, so SI today, but not Thursday, yeah. Because the college is locked down. Okay. Okay. So no test this week, no test next week, but then you got the final, I think, the week after that. Or is it 2 weeks after that? It's the 15th. It's on Monday. Okay, so I'll bring in my schedule next time, and we'll just confirm the time. But that's not a cumulative test. It's just a simple test. All right, let's talk about the functions of the circulatory system. Well, it's composed of the heart, which develops a pressure gradient, and blood vessels. So it functions in transportation of nutrients and hormones and respiratory gases necessary for respiration, as well as waste product removal. That includes like carbon dioxide, which is a gas, but also other metabolites, for instance, like urea and other kinds of breakdown products. They're carried in the blood to be excreted by your lungs or by the kidney. But it's also important in terms of temperature regulation, because we're homeothermic. Our body temperature, our bodies operate at 98.8 degrees, 98.6 degrees. Various parts of our body do become heated with activity, like muscles. Well, blood flowing through that muscle will pick up that heat, and then that heat will be transferred to our integument and released into the atmosphere, cooling our bodies down. So heat transfer is an important function. All right, immune function is very important. White blood cells fight infections. And there are a number of different kinds of white blood cells. We'll take a look at a couple of different kinds of white blood cells. And then the last thing is, what kind of tissue is blood? What kind of tissue is it? Connective tissue. It's a little bit of a strange kind of connective tissue, because most connective tissues that we're aware of, like bone or tendon, is solid, right? Connects our bodies together. It's a solid structure. Blood, on the other hand, is a fluid connective tissue. And so that means it can flow through the body, carrying all these different things that we were just talking about. But it also means that if there is injury to a blood vessel, what's going to happen to that fluid? It's going to flow right out. So another important function of blood is when there is damage to a blood vessel, blood has the ability to stop blood loss. We call that hemostasis. So that's another function of the blood, is to promote hemostasis or blood clotting function. Okay. So the circulatory system is comprised of the heart and the vascular system, as well as the lymphatic system. The heart pumps blood through the cardiovascular system. Blood vessels carry blood from the heart to the cells and then back again. So what's the definition of an artery? What's an artery? It's a blood vessel that does what? It carries blood away from the heart. What's a good definition of a vein? It carries blood back to the heart, irrespective of what kind of compounds are in there. You'll find arteries that are oxygenated. You'll find arteries that are deoxygenated, so you might have to go back, review your anatomy a little bit. Okay, and there are three main kinds of blood vessels. And we have actually five on this list right here, but there's three main kinds. There's arteries, there's veins, and something in between, and that is the capillary. So what kind of blood vessel allows for exchange? Only capillaries. So why is it that capillaries allow for exchange but not arteries and veins? And that is because the structure of the wall, right, the capillaries are thin. There's only the endothelium, which is a simple squamous epithelium. All the other blood vessels are very thick. They have many layers, including elastic tissue and muscle tissue, way too thick to allow for diffusion. So capillaries are really the only functional place in terms of exchange. And the lymphatic system picks up tissue fluid that is filtered out of capillary beds and returns that fluid back to a subclavian vein, either the right or left subclavian vein. So fluid actually does leave capillaries. And what's the fluid part of blood called? I don't know if you would really know this, but it's a reasonable question for me to ask. And maybe you have a feel for that. And the fluid part of blood is plasma. The cellular part of blood that is what we call formed elements. And those are made up of red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. Okay, so the lymphatic system never picks up white blood cells or red blood cells because they stay in the cardiovascular system. But tissue fluid, right, which has come from plasma, is returned to the cardiovascular system via the lymphatic system. And as lymph returns to the heart, it's filtered, at least by one lymph node as it goes back to the heart or to the subclavian vein. Okay, so the composition of blood, we got the two main components. We got plasma and we have formed elements, right? So if we look at this whole test tube right here, that's what we call whole blood, okay? And whole blood is made up of the formed elements and blood plasma. And sometimes we would like to know what is the percentage of formed elements in whole blood. So we would let this test tube settle overnight or put it in a centrifuge and spin the cells down very quickly in just a minute or so. So all the heavy stuff ends up at the bottom of the test tube. And we measure a quantity called hematocrit, and the hematocrit is just the percentage of red blood cells that we find in whole blood. So does this volume of red blood cells in this centrifuge tube look, what is this as a percentage of the whole sample? Does it look like it's 50%? It looks what, a little bit less, right? So indeed it is. So hematocrit should typically be around 45%, probably maximally for women, probably a little bit less, maybe 42%, something of that nature. Okay, so this is red blood cells. What's another name for a red blood cell? That's an erythrocyte. And so erythro means red. This almost minuscule region right here, call that the buffy coat. It doesn't really matter if you include that in the hematocrit or not because it's usually only about 1% or less. These are leukocytes. And guess what leuko means? It means white. Right, leukocytes. So it's a white cell. And erythrocytes look red because they're loaded with a chemical compound that carries oxygen, and that's hemoglobin. So there's an iron molecule that's incorporated into heme and then some proteins to make hemoglobin, and that's a pigment. And it looks red when it's bound to oxygen. But white blood cells don't contain hemoglobin, so it just looks like any other normal kind of tissue, which is kind of cream-colored or white or a buffy color to it. Okay, so here you can see some nice erythrocytes and all these other cells that don't look red. Those are either leukocytes, and these small fragments over here are what we call thrombocytes or platelets. Okay, so red blood cell function is to carry oxygen, to a lesser extent, a waste product of carbon dioxide. And because carbon dioxide isn't transported in the blood as carbon dioxide, it's transported as a different chemical compound. White blood cells fight infection. And platelets, what do platelets do? They clot, right? They prevent blood loss. Okay. Yeah, I'll talk about what a scab is in just a little bit. There's something else real important going on there. Okay, but a scab does form when you lose blood from a blood vessel. Okay, all right, well, we talked about all that already. Plasma, what is plasma made up of? It's mostly made out of water. Okay, but there are some nutrients that are dissolved in plasma, and there are some proteins dissolved in plasma as well. Here are some different kinds of proteins that are dissolved in plasma. There's albumin that accounts for almost 80% of the protein that's in plasma. Not 80% of plasma are albumins, but of the proteins that are in blood, 80% are albumins. And this creates a colloid osmotic pressure. All right, so what is that actually doing? When blood gets into a capillary, fluid is pushed out of the capillary due to pressure. Pressure decreases as blood goes through the capillary, and that fluid surrounds tissues. Well, you don't want your body to fill up with fluid, so at the other end of the capillary, there's a force that's drawing fluid back in to the capillary, and that force is produced by albumins that are in your blood. So how does that work? I think you're familiar with this because of diffusion. If we have a membrane like a capillary, and we have, say, a 10% solution of protein on this side and a 1% solution of protein on this side of the membrane, okay? And so what's the water concentration here? 90%. And what's the water concentration over here? 99%. All right, so this is H2O, and it's not permeable to this protein, but it is permeable to water. Which way is water going to go? It's going to go, what's higher, 99 or 90? 99 is higher, so by diffusion, water go from high to low. So here's a capillary wall. Water will move back in at the distal end of a capillary. So for instance, this is going to be the tissue space. And this is the blood. All right, so water will be reabsorbed from tissues back into the circulatory system because of that albumin that is in the circulatory system. And that albumin comes from the liver, so if somebody has a damaged liver and it's not producing albumin, guess what happens to this fluid that's in the tissues? It stays there, it produces edema due to liver damage, okay, because of albumins. Okay, a couple other proteins that we have. Globulins carry lipids around because lipids are not soluble. Even lipid hormones are carried by globulins. And another class of globulins are gamma globulins. These are antibodies. We're going to talk about antibodies in just a little bit. So these things fight infection and also rejection of foreign tissues in your body. And the third component is fibrinogen. Okay, so whenever you see a term with an ogen at the end of it, what does that mean? Did I write that on the board? I can't remember if I ever told you how to do that. I think I did. Remember, if there's a word with a pro as a prefix, like a proenzyme, what does that mean? It's inactive, but ready to be converted into an active form right away. If there's a suffix, ogen, at the end of a word, that also means it is inactive, but it can be activated at a moment's notice by a certain kind of mechanism. So fibrinogen is what? Active or inactive? Yeah. It is inactive. That's right. But it can become activated very quickly. All right? And so fibrinogen, since it's dissolved, that means it's soluble in water. But when it's converted to fibrin is not soluble in water. So what do we say happens to a compound when it comes out of solution? It's called a precipitate. It precipitates out. This protein precipitates out. Okay, and fibrin then forms a net or a mesh or a network of protein filaments like this. Okay, it just forms a network, and that acts as a patch over a damaged blood vessel. And as blood is leaking out, it traps platelets and red blood cells and white blood cells. Okay, and that's what forms a clot, and then after it dries out, that's what forms a scab. Okay, so the basic structure of a clot is what? A fibrin network. And where does that come from? That comes from fibrinogen. So those are the three kinds of proteins, and pretty much what they do in plasma. Okay. Okay, so we talked about most of this stuff on this slide, except for some functions of these guys over here. These are erythrocytes. These are loaded with a chemical compound called hemoglobin, which carry oxygen. And notice in these white blood cells here, you can see a nucleus very easily. But inside an erythrocyte, right, there is no nucleus. And there are no organelles inside a red blood cell. It's completely filled up with hemoglobin so that it can carry oxygen to your tissues. And as such, since they don't have any nucleus, it can't undergo protein synthesis. It can't respond to different challenges by changing metabolism inside the cell or building different kinds of enzymes. So it has a very limited lifespan. Does anybody know how long a red blood cell lives for? About 120 days. So it has a very short life and then it dies. And it's recycled in the body because blood is being filtered by the spleen and by the liver. So the spleen and liver get rid of old and damaged red blood cells. And we lose a tremendous amount of red blood cells every second because they don't live a very long time. And the generally accepted number in a healthy person is between 2.5 and 3 million red blood cells die in your body every second. So what's that condition called when you run out of red blood cells or your red blood cell level is low, abnormally low? Anemia, that's right. Okay. So if you lose 2.5 or 3 million red blood cells every second, how many does your body have to make every second so that you don't become anemic? It's got to be the exact same number to keep that nice balance. So your body has to produce 2.5 to 3 million every second, which turns out to be about 300 billion each day. That's about almost how much money we're giving away every day, the federal government. Okay? So that's a huge metabolic burden on your body to produce that many red blood cells, but to get rid of all of the other ones that are dying. Okay. And each red blood cell contains about 280 million hemoglobin molecules. Okay. Okay, so that's these guys right here. The kind of tissue that produces red blood cells is red bone marrow. Red bone marrow produces red blood cells. And don't forget, platelets are formed elements too. They don't have a nucleus. They have a very short lifespan as well. The kinds of white blood cells, neutrophils, the most common. Eosinophils, basophils, I probably won't talk about these, but these help regulate the inflammatory process. Neutrophils most directly fight infection by phagocytosis. Monocytes fight infection by phagocytosis as well. And these are interesting shapeshifters because they can squish around between cells. They can leave through slits between cells in a capillary. They can squeeze right through. And when a monocyte leaves the cardiovascular system, they become something we call a macrophage. And so we have millions of macrophages crawling around in all of our spaces of our body looking for bacteria and viruses, other kinds of pathogens, and they phagocytize them. So our lungs are loaded with macrophages because we're breathing in all kinds of stuff all the time. Lymphocytes also help fight infection, and there are two different kinds of lymphocytes, two major kinds of lymphocytes that fight infections. There's a B lymphocyte as well as a T lymphocyte, which I might come back to a little bit later on. So when I say lymphocyte, you should immediately think, where do you find lymphocytes? You find them in the blood, and they are just a kind of white blood cell. Okay, lymphocyte is a kind of white blood cell. Okay. Okay, so that monocyte moves by diapedesis. That means it's a shapeshifter. It could squeeze between a couple cells. Actually, and it can move around through the body like an amoeba. Okay. I'm not going to test you about granular versus agranular leukocytes. Okay. Platelets only last for about 9 days. These are important in hemostasis. All right. Hematopoiesis. kind of a funny term. This is just the production of blood. All right. So hemopoiesis is the formation of blood cells from stem cells in bone marrow. And exactly what kind of bone marrow you have? Yeah, red bone marrow. Okay. And the other kind of marrow we have in bones is just adipose tissue, okay, or yellow marrow. But in the fetus, that doesn't occur in bone marrow, it occurs in the liver. So the production of erythrocytes is what we call erythropoiesis, and it's stimulated by a hormone called erythropoietin. And we used to actually get erythropoietin from cadavers, so when people were terribly anemic, maybe due to chemotherapy or something, they were given erythropoietin that was harvested from other individuals and then injected, so you can imagine how expensive that was. Well, somebody found the gene for erythropoietin and then trained bacteria how to synthesize that protein in a test tube, and so all day long and all night long these bacteria synthesize erythropoietin and secrete it into the test tube, and then just by aspirating from the test tube we get erythropoietin. And that genetically engineered form of erythropoietin is called EPO, which is a lot cheaper and a lot more available. Okay, erythropoietin comes from the kidney. And the kidney secretes erythropoietin when oxygen concentration of the blood decreases. All right, so if oxygen concentration decreases, what can you tell me about the number of red blood cells in somebody? Is it increasing or decreasing? It's decreasing. Yeah, you're right. It's decreasing. So as oxygen goes down, that is due to decreased hemoglobin or decreased red blood cells. The kidney monitors that, and when the oxygen concentration goes down, red blood cell count goes down, kidney releases erythropoietin, which goes to red bone marrow, stimulates red bone marrow to produce red blood cells. So that's the response. And as you increase red blood cells, what happens to oxygen concentration in the blood? It increases, right? So that's the response. How does that correspond to the stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract from it? It subtracts. So that's a nice negative feedback loop, right? Maintaining hemostasis in oxygen concentration. So erythropoietin from the kidney, because the kidney can measure oxygen concentration, helps regulate erythropoiesis. Okay, leukopoiesis is stimulated by a number of cytokines, and we could actually call those leukopoietin as well. These are regulators secreted by the immune system based on the infectious burden that a person is experiencing at a particular moment. Okay, so the immune system works in a negative feedback loop to produce more or less white blood cells. Okay, so here you have erythrocytes, and you lose millions every second, and not everything is lost, right? Because you have hemoglobin. All right, so the globin is the protein part of this term. Heme is a large organic molecule that contains iron. So your body tries to recycle some of these elements. So hemoglobin is broken down into a couple things. First, it's broken down into globins, okay, and also heme. And globins are then broken down into amino acids. What can you do with amino acids? Wonderful thing. You can make more proteins, any kind of protein in your body, right? So these amino acids are recycled. Heme is broken down into iron, right? And that's used to make more hemoglobin. So that's not wasted, right? And then the remaining part of heme is broken down into biliverdin. And biliverdin is relatively toxic, so your body excretes it. And it excretes it because biliverdin is converted into bilirubin. Okay, and then that's excreted by the liver into the gallbladder, into the intestines, and then the majority is then excreted in the feces. Okay, So, can anybody tell me what color this looks like? This bilirubin right here? Okay. As a matter of fact, it's yellow. It's a yellow pigment. Okay. And what do we call that condition when somebody has a way above normal yellow color to their body? That's called jaundice. Okay. And so jaundice can develop by a couple of different conditions. If there is excessive breakdown of red blood cells, which is producing an excessive amount of bilirubin, more than the liver can handle, okay, that pigment will, and what's a pigment again? It's just a chemical compound that absorbs different spectra of light, right? It has a color to it. Okay, so somebody that's jaundiced, the whites of their eyes will be kind of bright yellow, fingertips, okay, bright yellow. It's very noticeable. So jaundice can be produced if there's an excessive number of red blood cells that are being broken down, or even by liver damage. Okay, so if somebody's liver is damaged, maybe alcoholism or chemotherapy or other kind of condition, that's going to produce jaundice. And even newborn babies can be jaundiced. Why do you why is that? One of the two conditions, damaged liver or excessive breakdown of red blood cells. It's excessive breakdown of red blood cells in a newborn because there's a blood mismatch between the fetus and the mom, and the mom's immune system is attacking the fetal red blood cells, breaking them down. Okay, but usually we know this way ahead of time and can prevent that circumstance from happening. But nonetheless, that's an important measure. As soon as somebody's born, they look at your color, and that goes into a formula we call APGAR, which measures reflexes, respiratory rate, heart rate, and also color of the newborn. Okay, so that helps track that condition called erythroblastosis fetalis, which we're going to talk about in just a second. Okay, so iron is recycled back. So you should know the breakdown products of hemoglobin, the breakdown products of heme, and the breakdown products of globin. Okay? Okay. Okay. Sometimes, maybe when somebody has a hemorrhage, they need a transfusion. They need to get blood from somebody else. And is it possible to get blood from anybody if you've had a hemorrhage? Can you get blood from anybody? As a matter of fact, you can't. Only certain donors can you get blood from. All right? Because there can be an antibody antigen reaction. All right, let me erase this. All right, so transfusion reaction is an antigen / antibody reaction. Okay, and we just talked a little bit about blood clotting. The fancy word for blood clotting is coagulation. We're going to talk about coagulation in a little bit. But a transfusion reaction is a different kind of scenario. Okay, so we're going to talk about coagulation in a little bit. It's an antigen-antibody reaction, and when this happens, red blood cells clump together. The cells actually form like a crystal, a megacrystal, and when these blood cells form a crystal in your body, what happens? Your blood can't flow because it just forms this big crystal of red blood cells. It can't get through capillaries. And then those tissues die as a result of not getting oxygen. So this process is what we call agglutination. So what the heck is agglutination? It is an antigen-antibody reaction. Okay. And there are a number of blood groups when you get a transfusion that somebody's going to measure to make sure you don't get transfusion reaction, and one of the systems is the ABO system. And so somebody will want to be able to know what your blood type is for the ABO system. And we see in the ABO system there are four different blood types. All right, so what the heck is that? Well, let's start with what an antibody looks like. Does anybody know what an antibody looks like? I think of an antibody as like a little guy running around. It's a soluble protein, right? An antibody is a soluble protein. So I just erased where it could be found. Where is something soluble? Where is it found? On formed elements or plasma? It's in the plasma. So antibodies, right, we find in the plasma. And an antibody kind of looks like this. It's got a couple legs coming down with a couple arms coming up. There's no head on this guy, but it's got a couple legs and a couple arms. All right, and a couple receptor binding sites. So there's like two hands sticking up. Okay, but these hands have a special shape. All right, so for instance, this might be the shape of one of them, and it's going to be an identical shape over here, like that. All right, so can anybody see what letter that looks like so far? Okay, well, that's the antibody right here. And now here we have a red blood cell, but pretty much all the cells on your body have antigens. And where we find antigens, so this is a nice red blood cell right here, is sticking off the plasma membrane of these cells. And they are markers. They identify these cells belonging to your body. So antigens are little markers sticking up. Because remember, this plasma membrane, you could think of it as the phospholipid bilayer. That's kind of a simple idea. The more advanced idea of a plasma membrane is what's another model you can use in your mind to describe a plasma membrane. It's a fluid mosaic model. So not only is it the phospholipid bilayer, but it's all kinds of other stuff stuck inside the membrane, like transporters, receptors, as well enzymes, right? But also antigens. So sticking off the cell of this red blood cell will be antigens. And so they started studying this, and they found an antigen. The first one they found, guess what they called the first one they found? Number A. Okay, so they didn't give it a number. They called it A. All right, and it had a certain shape. So we'll call that shape A. Bless you. All right, it doesn't mean that it looks like an A. It just has a particular shape. And the next one over here has the same shape. So what is that going to look like? Just say A, because it's the first one. Okay, and what about this one here? A. Okay, so on the surface of this red blood cell, it's loaded with A-shaped antigens. Right? All right, but now let's look at this antibody over here that's in the plasma. Can this antibody bind to anything on this red blood cell? Yeah, because why? Because of the lock and key model and how we explain how substrates can bind to active sites. So here's the active site. It just has the proper shape to do what? To fit into this antigen right here. Okay, so here's that A. And if it's bound to an antibody, okay, an antibody can come, bind to it like this. And guess what can bind over here? Another red blood cell, right, that has an A on it. So now these two cells are stuck together, okay? And furthermore, you have millions of these antibodies in your blood, and what can happen? Millions of these red blood cells then can get stuck together all in one big clump. So the clumping of blood due to this antibody-antigen reaction is what we call agglutination. Okay, so that's agglutination. So this antibody right here is what we call anti-A, or antibody A. All right, so you have to know that agglutination is due to an antibody-antigen reaction, but also, why do we give somebody the characterization of type A or type B or type AB or O type blood? And that is due to just strictly by the antigen that's on the surface of that red blood cell. That's the blood type somebody is, by the antigen that's on the red blood cell. So what's the blood type of this person right here in terms of just the ABO system? Are they type A or B or AB or O? It's just strictly A. And they're just type A because they only have the A antigen on the surface of these red blood cells. Right? They can't be blood type B or O or whatever. All right, so what does this antibody look like to you? That would look like an anti-B, right? That's antibody B. And where would you find anti-B? Would you find it in the plasma or on the cell surface? Okay, this is what? Antibody B. You find antibodies in the plasma. You find antigens on the cell surface right here. Okay, so typical kinds of questions that I'd like to have on the test, for instance. Let's try some. Okay, let's try some. What's the blood type? So again, how do you define somebody's blood type? It's just by the antigens on the plasma membrane. So what would be the blood type of this person here? AB, right? Because they have A antigens and B antigens. What would be the blood type? All right, so guess how they came up with blood type B? Somebody was messing around looking for these A antigens and they found another one. They go, oh, well, it doesn't have the A shape. That's got some other kind of shape. Let's call it antigen number 2. We'll have A and 2. And then somebody said, well, that doesn't make sense. If we name the first one A, let's make the second one what? B. Okay? All right, but now they found some red blood cells that were looking for A's and B's, and they didn't find any. So what are you going to call a blood type that doesn't have any antigens on the surface of the cell? You would call it 0, right? But you have B and A. Could you have 0? It doesn't make sense. So somebody had a great idea, and they go, oh, I got an idea. Let's call it O for 0. All right, so what blood type is this right here? That's O, right? Because there are no antigens on the plasma membrane. Okay. So those kinds of things I could put on the test. You'd have to tell me what blood type that is. All right, but let's make a table of blood types. Okay, so let's just say, what are the principles involved with agglutination? What are the two entities that have to interact? Antigen and antibody. All right, so let's just say antigen and antibody right here. All right, where do we find the antigen? The cell surface, the plasma membrane. Where do we find antibodies? In the plasma. So I'll just make a little, you know, wavy line right here for fluid. Okay. And then let's just say, what are the blood types again? You got A, you got B, AB, and you got blood type O. So here's a nice table. You can make this table during the test, for instance, if need be. Okay, just like that. But the key is you got to remember where the antigens are located. They're on the cell surface. So if somebody's blood type A, what do they have? A antigens. Okay, and the way the system works, if you have A antigens, you automatically have certain antibodies in your blood ready to go to work. Can you have anti-A in your blood and not be breathing for very long? So you're going to have what? Anti-B, or antibody B, that's just short form. All right, so if you're ever transfused with somebody with B blood type, okay, these anti-Bs are going to kill those cells. That's called a mismatch. All right. What about a person with B-type blood? What kind of antigens do they have? None. They only have B. What kind of antibodies? Anti-A. AB is what? What kind of antigens? Both. A and B. Ah, but now what about antibodies? Can't have any. All right. So none. Neither. Neither A nor B. And type O, what kind of antigens? None. Now, what about antibodies? They actually have both. They have both anti-A and anti-B. So if you ever get confused, board exam or whatever, just draw that little chart right there. As long as you can get a picture in your mind of where those antigens are located. They're where? On the surface of the cell sticking out like that. Okay. So that's the ABO system. There are many others that are just as important. Here you have a little antibody right here, this little guy with the proper hands on it. These are the antigens. Lock and key model explains how antibodies bind to antigens, right? And they can link up many, many times over. And this is what the little crystals of clumped red blood cells look like. That's not even underneath a microscope, right? It just forms this granular spot on a microscope slide. I don't think we ever did that in lab. Maybe you did do that in lab. I can't remember. I think you agglutinated something. Okay, and that's a transfusion reaction. Now there's another blood typing system, and that's called the Rh factor. Rh factor is a little bit simpler. I guess I could leave that up. Rh factor just is a result of either having an antigen on the surface of a cell or not having it. All right, so if there are only two possibilities, this is how we talk about it. It's either plus or minus. If it's Rh plus, guess what you have? You have the, just like if you're blood type A, you have the A antigen. If you're Rh plus, that means you have the Rh antigen on the surface of the red blood cell. And if you're Rh minus, you don't have the antigen. Okay, so what would that look like kind of schematically? Antigens are on the surface of the cell. All right, so I could give you a couple examples right here. All right, what are these different blood types? So what blood type is this? Okay, in terms of the ABO system and the Rh. It is AB positive. And what's this one here? This is AB and no Rh. That's negative, AB negative. What's this one here? O negative, because it doesn't have any antigens. It doesn't have the Rh or the A or B. Okay, so there is a condition when we can get a transfusion reaction taking place because we have a person living inside another person. When does that happen? Yeah, during gestation, right? During pregnancy, where you have a fetus. And if the blood type is a mismatch in the Rh system, then there can be problems for the fetus. Okay. Oh, one thing I didn't tell you. This person right here, all right, what's the blood type of this person? Well, it was AB, but I took it away. So it's really O. It's O positive. Okay. So unlike the ABO system, this person, even though they're Rh positive, they don't normally produce anti-Rh, the antibody. Okay. But these people automatically produce anti-B or anti-A depending on what antigens they have. Right, this doesn't necessarily always happen. But if for some reason this person has ever had introduced into... Oh, no, that's not what I want to say. Talk about this one right here. Could this person ever normally produce anti-Rh? No, because that would be fatal, right? That would kill their own blood. But what about this person here? What's the blood type of this person? O negative. Could this person produce anti-Rh and still live? Yeah, no problem, right? Because there's no antigen right there. Well, let's just say that this is the mom right here, and under most circumstances, this person doesn't produce any anti-Rh. This doesn't happen, okay? But that does happen for the ABO system. Okay, but this person can produce anti-Rh if they're pre-sensitized. That means if they were ever given a transfusion or if they ever had blood mixed from anybody else that was this over here, so these Rh antigens could stimulate the production of anti-Rh in this person right here. So due to a transfusion reaction or maybe a previous pregnancy, because during parturition there's always exchange of blood. All right, so here we have the mom that is what, negative? But what happens if mom had a baby with dad and dad is, what's the blood type of dad right here? This is O positive. All right, so the baby has a 50% chance being negative or positive, so a 50-50 chance. So now you got a baby down over here that is Rh positive. Let's just take one scenario. Rh positive, now the baby is living where? In mom, okay, with these antigens. All right, the first pregnancy, there's usually no deleterious effects. There's usually no transfusion reaction, but after the mom is sensitized by the first delivery, right, the second pregnancy, if it's Rh positive, then this mother's immune system can attack the red blood cells in this fetus. And it's going to destroy these red blood cells. Okay, so that is not only going to destroy the red blood cells and present developmental problems, but what's the breakdown product that's being produced? Bilirubin, which is a neurotoxin. Okay, that's going to prevent development of the fetus. All right, so we want to prevent this condition from happening. We call this erythroblastosis fetalis, or hemolytic disease of the newborn. Okay, and so that happens when the baby is Rh positive and the mom is Rh negative. Okay, that also means, has to be, that the dad is Rh, doesn't have to be O, it could be ABO, but it has to be Rh positive. Okay. Well, interesting question is, why is it that the Rh system can produce erythroblastosis fetalis, but not the ABO system? You never hear of a mismatch or in the fetus, right? Say maybe the mom was O and the dad was AB, and it just so happened the baby turned out to be AB. Why doesn't the mom produce antibodies, anti-A and anti-B, and kill the fetus's blood for the ABO system? That's sort of an interesting question. And the reason is because anti-A and B are large. These are large antibodies. They can't get through the placenta. But the anti-Rh, they're small. They can get through the placenta, right, into the fetus and cause problems. All right, so that's that is problems in agglutination. So when you think of agglutination, what's one word that kind of describes agglutination? What kind of reaction is it? It's an antibody antigen reaction that forms the clumping of red blood cells together. Okay, and don't forget, where are the antigens located? Surface of the cell. Antibodies are soluble, floating around in the plasma, right? Okay. Okay, as opposed to clot formation. Clot formation is not agglutination, because agglutination is antibody antigen reaction. The process of maintaining hemostasis is what we call coagulation. Coagulation. It's a different process. Does not require antibodies and antigens for that to happen. Has nothing to do with that. But we did mention what was involved in coagulation already. It's the formation of a certain kind of protein. And what was that certain kind of protein called? That was fibrin. Fibrin is the protein. So fibrin formation translates into coagulation. Fibrin formation. Two different kinds of processes. All right, so the bottom line is transfusion reaction happens due to antibody antigen reaction, but blood clotting which seems kind of similar, totally different mechanism, is due to what? Fibrin formation, which is that network of fibrin proteins that traps red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets and forms a clot. Okay. You know, I don't think I'm going to talk about any of these slides right here. For minor kinds of tears within a blood vessel, like at the cellular level, and just would include maybe 1 to 10 cells, which is a very minor kind of vascular insult, that can be plugged up, right, with just platelets. We call that platelet plug formation. That's one kind of coagulation. Okay. But for major tears in a blood vessel, then these platelet plugs are not sufficient to plug up a blood vessel, and that's when you need fibrin formation to form a net over that large rip in a blood vessel. Okay. All right, so coagulation is just the conversion of fibrinogen, which is, what can you tell me about fibrinogen? It's inactive. It can be converted into an active form, fibrin. It precipitates out, forming that network. So there is an enzyme that's used to convert fibrinogen to fibrin. All right, so do you think it's kind of important to have control over this coagulation process in your body? Or? Yeah, because your blood is designed to flow from one part to another. What would to happen if all of a sudden all the blood in your body turned into a solid, it coagulated? What would happen to you? Yeah, nothing could flow. You couldn't transfer heat, right? You couldn't deliver nutrients, take away waste products. You couldn't deliver oxygen to the tissues. So when oxygen can't get to your brain, how long does your brain have? 3 seconds, you lose consciousness. 3 minutes, you're dead. So this has got to be a very well-regulated process. And, you know, it happens to some people where they lose control of their blood clotting function. And their blood starts to clot everywhere in their body. It's very difficult to treat, very serious. Usually the outcome is very poor as a result. So there's some mechanisms involved with coagulation. So there are two. There's an intrinsic pathway and an extrinsic pathway. Okay, and I think I'll show you what these two pathways are. But you can see, one thing I want to point out, calcium is very important for controlling these coagulation pathways or clotting pathways. All right, so probably before you took a human anatomy or physiology class, what was the reason why you had calcium in your body?
Bones.
For bones, making bones strong. That's a hell of a nice reason to have calcium in your body. I like having strong bones. But what else is calcium important for? Muscle contraction. Synaptic transmission. Okay, both of those I would prefer over strong bones. Now here's another one, and that is coagulation or preventing blood loss. Okay, the proper calcium levels in your body. So bones are kind of getting shoved down to one of the last important places to have calcium. And if you don't have calcium in your blood and you've got a little paper cut, guess what? You could bleed to death with just a little paper cut. If your blood doesn't coagulate, it might take a while, but if it never stops bleeding, okay, you're really out of luck. Okay, so here is the extrinsic pathway and the intrinsic pathway, and let's start. It looks a little complicated, but I might actually go back and talk about this next time as well, but let's look at this last step. Okay, so fibrin polymer. What does that mean? That means that this protein has precipitated out of solution, and it's a solid substance, but what does it form? Does it form like a crystal? What's the best way to think of fibrin? As a net or a mesh that traps cells as blood starts to flow through it. So this is the last step in coagulation, is what? Fibrin formation. This is the last step. Oh, I'm going to write the steps, the important steps on the board for you to know. Okay. The other thing that you should know is, what is the name of the enzyme that converts fibrinogen to fibrin? And that's on the slide right here. It's a part of the common pathway kind of down at the bottom. That is an enzyme called thrombin. Okay, thrombin. Now, should thrombin be active in your blood all the time? No, because that's going to produce blood clots all the time. That's going to produce heart attacks, strokes, or intravascular disseminated coagulopathy, which means that your blood is just going to form this big clot all over, okay, which is bad. So thrombin is not activated, but your body makes it all the time ready so that it can jump into action at a moment's notice so you don't bleed to death. So what's the inactive form of thrombin called? Prothrombin, right, just by nomenclature. Right, prothrombin is the inactive form. So there has to be something that converts prothrombin to thrombin, and that is this factor 10 right here, which is what I'm going to call prothrombin activator. All right, so prothrombin activator activates prothrombin by converting it into thrombin, and thrombin converts fibrinogen, huh? That X is 10, yeah, factor 10, Roman numeral 10. Okay, and so here are other factors like 5, 10, 11. So there's lots of blood clotting factors, and I don't think we're going to explore the activity of all these different cofactors right here and what pathways they're involved with. But I tell you what, when you look at this kind of complicated scheme, for instance, where you have maybe one enzyme activating hundreds of other kinds of factors, which then can activate thousands of other kinds of factors, which then can activate tens of thousands of other kinds of factors. What do we call that? And what's it used for? That's a cascade, so that's a level of what? Amplification. So a little small signal can effect a change in a hurry and produce a relatively large effect, preserving your blood volume. Okay, so how does prothrombin activator become activated? Okay. Well, for instance, it can be activated by when blood comes in contact with collagen. What is collagen? Where did you run into collagen ever? What kind of tissue do you find collagen in? That's the tensile chemical, the thing that reduces stretching in connective tissue, right? So that's just the basic things that we find in tendons and ligaments. But it's also found in blood vessels to give blood vessels integrity. So if a blood vessel gets damaged or ripped, the endothelium is ripped, and that then exposes collagen. Okay, so collagen then starts this cascade of events, right, which then produces prothrombin activator, along with platelet chemicals, and also calcium. Okay, so these are the three steps for coagulation. I'll erase the table down here, but you should be able to reproduce that. Just draw it out one time. I think it will make perfect sense. Okay. So the first step, I don't like that one so much. Prothrombin activator formation. The second step is thrombin formation. And what does thrombin do? What does thrombin do? And that's the third step? It converts fibrinogen into fibrin, so we're going to say fibrin formation. So these are kind of the breakdown of the three steps in what? Agglutination or coagulation? That would be coagulation. Okay. And the stimulus for prothrombin activator formation is damage to a blood vessel that exposes collagen to the blood. Right? And as long as there's no collagen exposed to the blood, it is rare for blood to form blood clots under at least normal circumstances. Okay, so that's what I want you to know about coagulation. Prothrombin activator formation, thrombin formation, and then fibrin formation. Okay. So here are all the factors that we're not going to be really concerned about. Okay, but you should at least be aware of some of these. One important one is clotting factor number 4. That's calcium ions. Okay. And a lot of these clotting factors are produced by the liver. All right, so you need to have a healthy liver. If you don't have a healthy liver, then you're going to have decreased clotting function. Okay. Now, what can you tell me about the autonomic nervous system? What's kind of interesting about the autonomic nervous system? It's what kind of control does it operate under? Okay, how many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have? There's 2. Okay. How do they operate with respect to each other? That's what I was after. They're antagonistic to each other. But because, and that's really a good thing, because they operate antagonistic to each other, you have precise control and balance over what? Autonomic functions in your body. Okay. Well, do you think having control over blood clotting is important? Would you like to be able to control that? Absolutely. So guess what? There is an antagonistic system that controls the extent of clot formation as well. So if you have a mechanism that produces blood clots, does it seem reasonable for you to have an extensive mechanism to reverse blood clots? Yeah, sure, because if you get a paper cut on one finger, and even though you have normal blood clotting, you don't want a blood clot in your other hand, you just want it where you need it, right? So there's got to be mechanisms that limit clot formation. And that's under antagonistic control in your body. All right, so when damage is repaired, right, when it starts to come under control, activation factor 7 causes activation of kallikrein. Kallikrein converts plasminogen. Okay, what can you tell me about plasminogen? It's inactive. You got gobs in your body ready to go to work, but it's not going to work unless it gets the proper signal, right, which is kallikrein. And so plasminogen is converted into plasmin. And guess what the beauty of plasmin is? It digests fibrin, right? So that limits, number one, the extent of clot formation. But this also then dissolves the clot once the damage to the blood vessel has been repaired. So plasmin will dissolve a clot. And it's used clinically these days. What could you use plasmin for? Well, for instance, sometimes somebody will be generating blood clots pathologically, and these blood clots might end up in the heart, blocking a blood supply to the heart. What do we call that? When somebody has an occlusion of a blood vessel, a coronary artery, to the heart. What's going to happen to the heart? It needs oxygen because it's working all the time. That part of the heart is going to die. That's what we call a heart attack. Okay? Okay. Yeah, and that's going to produce myocardial infarction. You can also get that same condition happening in the brain, right? If there's a blood vessel in the brain that gets plugged by a thrombus. What do we call that? Okay, yeah, cerebral vascular incident. We could call it a brain attack, but we typically don't. That's what we call a stroke, for instance. That's a stroke. So you're probably familiar with heart attacks and strokes. And if a stroke is caused by blood clots, okay, they can be given, for instance, plasmin or other kinds of clot-dissolving chemicals, right, if it's diagnosed soon enough to dissolve that clot so that that part of the brain reperfuses quickly enough, all right, and it preserves that part of the brain. It won't necrose, it won't infarct, it won't die. But what kind of time frame are we talking about here? How long do you have if you have a stroke? Can you go in next week? Okay, as soon as possible. Okay, certainly as soon as possible. And not every place in the country can do that, but LA's got a lot of good hospitals, like Memorial can do this, I'm sure, Cedars-Sinai, right? Major hospitals can do this. So if you have any family members and they're starting to act a little loopy and you know that they're usually level-headed people, okay, and they might be having a cerebral vascular incident, you know, don't let them deny their symptoms. Get them into emergency room right away, and that can almost like immediately reverse the effects of a stroke. And so what's better? Having to learn how to reuse your arm and how to swallow so that you can eat for the next 12 months, or just get that stroke magically taken away. All right, so act quickly and, you know, support people getting into the ER to get that blood clot dissolved. So that's actually kind of a magical therapy, but strokes can be produced by a couple of different mechanisms. One is a blood clot that's blocking a blood vessel, but another one can be produced by maybe an aneurysm, which is a bulge in a blood vessel in the brain that breaks. All right, so then the blood is leaking out of the blood vessel in the brain. And in those conditions, would you like to give somebody plasmin? If somebody's having a stroke due to a bleed in the brain, no, that would be worse. What? That would make that pathology much, much worse. So when somebody's having a stroke, it's got to be diagnosed quickly. And if it's a clot, it can be dissolved. But if it's a bleed, then you can't give this kind of treatment. Okay? Okay, so that's a different scenario altogether. Anticoagulants. How did you guys talk about anticoagulants? Or how does a layperson talk about anticoagulants? Okay? Which is really, when you take a physiology class, it just sort of grates on your nerves when you hear this. Okay, they talk about it as blood thinners, right? An anticoagulant is a blood thinner, but does it really thin your blood? Does your blood get any thinner when you take a blood thinner? No, it has the same viscosity, right? The viscosity of your blood doesn't change, right? Remember Poiseuille's equation in lab? Viscosity was just the thickness of blood. Because coagulation is what? A cascade of events that are linked together, metabolism that's linked together. So an anticoagulant will disrupt that cascade of events, and it doesn't do it by diluting the blood one way or the other. So let's look at some anticoagulants. All right, so clotting can be prevented by calcium chelators. A chelator is just something that will grab up calcium and take that out of solution, like sodium citrate or EDTA. That's not something that we'd ever want to give somebody, but that is something maybe that we could put in a test tube. Say if we want to take blood and analyze it, and we don't want it to turn into a solid, we can put some EDTA in a test tube, and that's going to prevent the blood from clotting because it's going to sequester the calcium ions from that sample, and it won't clot. It will stay a fluid for you to make measurements of. All right? Another kind of compound is heparin. That can be given clinically. All right? This activates antithrombin 3, which blocks the formation of thrombin. So what happens if you block the formation of thrombin? That blocks fibrin formation, which blocks that network that's produced, right? So that works as an anticoagulant. Can you take as much heparin as you want? No, it's got to be titrated perfectly, right? Because otherwise you're going to produce bleeding all over the place, right? So it's got to be the proper level. Another compound is coumadin or coumarin. This blocks clotting by inhibiting the activation of vitamin K. And vitamin K works indirectly by reducing calcium availability as well. All right, so vitamin K is a necessary compound for blood clotting function. And where do you get vitamin K from? Okay, where is a good dietary source of vitamin K? Without this in your diet, you'll probably have decreased blood clotting function. Now, K right here is not potassium. That's just a big organic molecule. Green leafy vegetables. So everybody's groaning. Okay. Green leafy vegetables, and a really good source of that is broccoli. Everybody's going, oh yeah, yeah, I love broccoli. That's wonderful. All right, so somebody that's on coumarin treatment, that dose has to be titrated, but what can you tell me about their dietary intake, for instance, of broccoli? Should they eat like a ton one day and none for a week and then a ton the next day? No, this should be constant because the coumarin levels have to be titrated to meet the individual's needs. And if their diet changes, that's going to change the function, the clotting function of their blood. And I sort of have a funny story regarding that and my nephews when they were growing up. Okay, they're three little boys. And guess what they like to do all the time? Horse around. Okay, so they would horse around a lot, and invariably somebody would come to me with a bloody nose because they're just goofing around. And so I'd say, okay, well, the first thing you got to do is eat some broccoli. And then the second thing, you know, put your head back and hold your nose and it will eventually stop bleeding. But they were really prone to having nosebleeds all the time. And during the supper table, at the supper table, they would never eat broccoli. Even though I showed them that whole extrinsic pathway, intrinsic pathway, and all the clotting factors and everything, could you believe they would just never eat broccoli and vitamin K? So, I mean, these kids would rather bleed to death than eat broccoli. So, I don't know how that happened. So, today I think they're eating broccoli. They finally learned how to do that. Huh? Just make a milkshake out of it or something, right, on St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, put cheese on it. Yeah, there's different things you can do. Okay. Also, another kind of interesting story. A lot of times when people raise birds, like parrots and things like that, they like to clip their wings, their feathers, so they don't fly away. And a lot of times you can cut down into the cuticle of a feather, which is vascular, and a lot of times it's very difficult to stop that bleeding. And that's because of improper diet that the bird has. So if you want to make sure birds have proper clotting function, what should you feed them? Broccoli. Okay, and that will increase their clotting function. Okay, same thing for probably a dog, and a lot of dogs will eat broccoli. they'll still yelp, but they probably won't bleed so much. Okay, so we're moving on to the heart, but I'm not going to cover a lot of this heart because, guess what, you already know this stuff. But for instance, let's just review. How many chambers does the heart have? Four, that's right, four chambers. How many valves does the heart have? Four. And if you can't say four and four off the tip of your tongue like that without thinking, then you got to go back and study your anatomy book, right? The two superior chambers are the atria. The two inferior are the ventricles. And what do you got between the atria and ventricles in terms of passageways for blood? The AV valves, right? And that an AV valve just prevents retrograde flow of blood from a ventricle back up into the atrium. Right, because if that valve is incompetent or it leaks, it's going to kill that side of the heart. So definitely that valve has to be repaired or replaced. Okay, and how many circulations does your cardiovascular system have? Two. And what are they? The pulmonary circulation, which goes to the lungs, and the systemic circulation, which goes everywhere else in the body. And what's the definition of an artery? Takes blood away from the heart, and a vein takes blood to the heart. Now, is there such a thing as a vein that carries oxygenated blood? Yeah. Then give me an example. The pulmonary vein, because it's coming back from the lungs. So it's coming back from the lungs. It's highly oxygenated, but it's still a vein because the blood is going to the heart. Right? So the pulmonary circulation is opposite compared to the systemic circulation. Right, so that's an important slide that you should look at. The only thing on this slide is that there's a connective tissue sheath between the atria and the ventricles called the fibrous skeleton. It doesn't contain myocytes. It's just connective tissue, and it has a number of important functions. The valves of the heart are all connected to that fibrous skeleton, so they don't move around. But the fibrous skeleton, all that collagen, doesn't conduct electrical impulses. So electrically, the atria are isolated from the ventricles. And that's pretty important because I think you realize what kind of synapse do different myocardial cells have? Okay? What kind of synapses between cells in the myocardium? Okay, they have gap junctions, so that means that sodium currents can directly go from one myocardial cell to the next, to the next, to the next, so that if one cell depolarizes in the atria, what happens to all the cells in the atrium? They depolarize, which is a signal for contraction. Okay, well, the fibrous skeleton allows for the atria to contract first, and then there's one special pathway that an action potential can use to travel from the atrium into the ventricle, and that's called the AV node. And that goes through the fibrous skeleton. So that's one of the interesting things about the fibrous skeleton is that it helps control the electrical activity of the heart and separates the atria from the ventricles. All right, that's just some more anatomy. Here's the fibrous skeleton that anchors the heart valves, but also electrically isolates the atria from the ventricles. All right, the resistance of the systemic circulation is a lot higher. That means the impedance to blood flow is a lot higher than the pulmonary circulation. So do you have a good feel for that? Why is that so? Why is that so? Why is the systemic circulation a lot more difficult to pump blood through compared to just the lungs? Yeah, you got a lot more tissues. It's a lot longer, right? So even think of Poiseuille's equation. The length of the blood vessel determines the amount of flow. Okay, so the left side of the heart, which is pumping blood through the systemic circulation, has to develop a lot higher pressure to get blood through the systemic circulation. The right side of the heart doesn't have to develop nearly the same kind of pressure to get blood to flow through the lungs because it's a much shorter circulation. The resistance is way reduced. So the work done by the left ventricle pumping to the systemic circulation is almost 10 times greater compared to the pulmonary circulation. All right, so when we look at the wall thickness of the right ventricle versus the left, you can, if it's an accurate diagram, but certainly in a real heart that's normal, the left ventricle should be what? Bigger, thicker, or thinner compared to the right? A lot thicker, probably 3 or 4 times thicker than the right ventricle. That's because the left develops much higher pressure compared to the pulmonary circulation. And when you measure blood pressure on your arm, what blood pressure are you measuring? Systemic blood pressure, right? And that's it. So that's a fairly high number. What's a typical ballpark measurement for systemic pressure? Like 120 over 80 is a good ballpark, right? All right, and guess what? Have you ever measured pulmonary pressure? No. It's really difficult to get at because where is it? It's deep inside your thoracic cavity. There's no way to put a pressure cuff on it. You can't introduce a catheter to it. It's very difficult to measure pressure in the pulmonary circulation, but just like the left side, the systemic circulation, people can suffer from hypertension. People can suffer from hypertension of the pulmonary circuit, and that's very difficult to diagnose and understand. Okay, I'll talk some more about that a little bit later. Heart valves. Well, you know the names of all the heart valves. What's a little saying that you know what this one is called compared to this one over here? Try before you buy, right? So there's a tricuspid, over here's the bicuspid, the atrial ventricular valves. You got papillary muscles that are attached to chorda tendineae, and the chorda tendineae are attached to the margins of these leaflets right here, preventing them from inverting. Okay, semilunar valves are between the ventricles and the great arteries coming off the base of the heart, the aortic semilunar versus the pulmonary semilunar. They don't have chorda tendineae or attached to papillary muscles. Okay, so go back maybe and read your anatomy book or notes on anatomy regarding the heart and its circulation. Okay, couple other things before we leave. The cardiac cycle. So the heart is not like an electric motor or an electric pump. If you have an electric motor and you plug it in, what does it do? It just runs all the time. Right, and it's pumping all the time. So an electric pump is pumping all the time. But is your heart pumping blood all the time? You know what? It's not. Okay, because your heart is what we call a reciprocating pump. That means that it pumps when it contracts, okay, and then it has to stop contracting. It's got to relax because in order to pump blood when it contracts, and this escaped clinicians and researchers for many years, in order to pump blood when it contracts, what has to happen? It's got to relax so that blood can fill the heart, right? So in terms of cardiac function, systolic function is when the heart contracts. That's very important. So if the heart isn't contracting, it's not pumping blood. But diastolic function is just as important. The heart has to relax quickly so that it can fill with blood so that when the heart does contract, it's got something to pump out. So those are the two phases of the heart cycle. There's systole, which is contraction, and diastole, which is relaxation, and both are very important, right? The heart won't function unless both of these phases are operating properly. And the way that the heart contracts is that both atria contract simultaneously, and the ventricles follow about 100 or 200 milliseconds after that. And that just helps load blood into the ventricles. That helps pump blood from the atria into the ventricles, so when the ventricles contract, they're maximally loaded up with blood. So don't forget, atria contract first, And then shortly thereafter, less than a second, about a tenth of a second, the ventricles contract. All right, okay. So I'm going to start here, the cardiac cycle, but we try to review these terms. I think you covered these in lab already, but it would be good if you were to review them again by next time. Okay? So just look at end diastolic volume, stroke volume, and systolic volume. These you didn't learn in anatomy.